And you know, the old famous Airbnb example, right? Like in 2006, you booked a room on Airbnb and the photos were real candid. Yeah. And yeah, you were like, I'm not going to rent that. That looks horrible. And but then Airbnb somehow figured out how to up the game and make certain properties look really, really nice. And then everybody else is like, oh, if I want to rent out my room, I better take better pictures.
Leading by example, yeah. Yeah.
And it's kind of the same. It's kind of the same thing we did. Like, even a relatively, like, let's say a non-blockbuster title on Disney Plus, if we do our job right, looks really good, looks really descriptive, looks like attractive, looks like it's maybe something I want to click on, or at least is clear on if you're the audience or somebody else is the audience.
Hi, Olaf. Thank you so much for taking time.
Hey, Sebastian. Great to be here. Looking forward to the chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Really looking forward. We have been talking since quite a while about like doing this podcast together. So it's good that we're doing it. It's also interesting time because you just switched jobs.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And for people context, maybe. So you have been at Disney for a long time, Disney Plus, being there in product and design, the VP of product and design. Now you just moved to Udemy, doing product design and research. There is the VP. And looking forward to dive into that. You have a long history working in media and intersection of media and design, even being involved in founding agencies and so on. And I think that's something that is going to be interesting to touch on. Looking forward to that. A big bandwidth of different experiences to dive into. Yeah. So I think like what would be really helpful, or just for the start, maybe we can just give people some context about like the short story of like the very long story that you could share.
The short story of the very long road. Yeah. You interrupt me if it becomes too long, but I think if you ask me the question, how I got into design, I think my answer would have to start with how I fell in love with computer graphics. And the story I'm telling it from kind of the beginning is really going to date me, and your listeners can probably calculate my age from that. But I really didn't really think much about what I was going to do with my life when I was 13. But one of the kids in the village that I grew up in had a Commodore 64, which was basically a keyboard that you can connect to a television. And there was no hard drive in it or floppy disk. And what we did is on the weekends, we would ride our bicycles to a small town. We'd buy a computer graphics magazine and we would type in assembly code into the Commodore 64. And when we were done typing in these 7 or 8 pages of cryptic binary code, you would hit the run command and you would get a video game. And for example, one of the video games was a hot air balloon that was flying across the screen and you had to land it without hitting a tree. And I think that experience that you can make a machine do motion graphics never left me. And it really kind of made a lot of my decisions happen going forward. Just to round out that story, by the way, if you turned off that computer, your video game was gone, right? There was no memory there that survived. The power switch. So from that time on, I didn't always have access to computers. But when I decided to go to art school in Germany, I ended up applying for the academy in Hamburg. And I had learned invested in a computer lab. And I had access to a Macintosh computer with a program called HyperCard, which essentially, if you want to think about it, was a web server in a box. Mm-hmm. I mean, a web server on a computer without the internet connected to it. You could build pages and you could make objects click on and they would go to other pages. And I had used it to kind of build interactive comic strips. I was really into illustration. That was one of my passions. And so I was the first student that applied for that university by handing in floppy disks. And it was kind of, it had the provocative effect that I intended, that some of the professors were unable to look at my portfolio because they just didn't have computers. But it kind of stirred up that conversation that computer graphics as an art form is definitely a possibility. And so I stayed with it. I worked in that computer lab. I kind of really tried to get into motion. There were computers called the Amiga. There was kind of a hardware called the video toaster, and you were able to do three-dimensional animations that literally took days to render. But for me, it was always that love of seeing that output, that fascination of kind of having deep control and almost a dialogue with the machine about what do I need to tweak to change the outcome, mm-hmm. and how do other people respond to it? Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting at the same time was that that art school in Hamburg, being a real art school and not a design mm-hmm. school, mm-hmm. meant that a lot of the professors that were doing research into the meaning of computing, it wasn't just the output or can you get a job with that, et cetera, it was the meaning of computing. And there was a professor, his name was Kurt Altleben. He passed away in 2019, and he gets the credit for building Germany's first computer graphic in 1960. There was somewhere in Germany, there was a computer probably the size of a house, and they were able to use some kind of dot matrix printer to output oscillating lines on paper. And he started thinking that maybe the computer is the first time that we have invented the other, like another form of consciousness, another form of dialogue. And it wasn't there that people would be communicating through computers like you and I are just doing, but they were thinking about, are we communicating with the computer and what's in there? And that the combination of me working in motion graphics and my professors kind of pushing us to think about, is there a dialogue happening? Is there, like, what does it mean for you, you know, to interact with this computer? That kind of kept me going in researching, you know, possible art forms that can come out of computer graphics. And I became part of a media art group that built essentially an experiment where we used computer graphics to build a completely autonomous television station that didn't have a moderator, and it ran for 100 days during an art festival called the Documenta. And long story short, artists generally thought it was the most genius thing that we had ever done. And the general public thought it was the worst television program ever, because it really kind of broke what television was meant for. It was kind of trying to put an internet chat on a TV screen and then hundreds of thousands of people are watching it. So it's not that interesting. But yeah, that kind of set me on the path to continuously work on computers. I would say that one of the threads through my career is that I've always interested in motion graphics, keeping things interactive, seeing how it can make things move. And that ultimately got me in contact with a few folks from the United States. I don't know if it's too long, interrupt me, but there's another interesting anecdote that kind of highlights the times. So during that art festival, there was a magazine called Mediamatic that wrote about media art. It was mm-hmm. a Dutch magazine. And because there wasn't really any email or I definitely didn't have a cell phone, the way that I met these folks from the United States was that one of them was on vacation in Amsterdam, and he bought that magazine and he read about the project that we were doing, and he literally changed his plans and came to Hamburg to meet with us. Mm-hmm. And when I met with him, he said, well, you should all come to the United States because there's a lot more people already thinking about this stuff. Like Silicon Valley had done, you know, a lot of work. There was a lot of energy around, you know, early computing, and Germany was a little bit behind. I think now it's more or less kind of a global, you know, the technology deploys globally much faster.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's when I bought my first ticket. Came to the United States.
Came to, yes. Was it then when you moved over? That wasn't your transfer, right? Back then to the US, because at some point you moved over, right?
No. So I did buy a ticket to go to SIGGRAPH.
First travel, right? That's the first travel there, essentially, right? And then
my first travel. And as a European at the time, I hadn't even been on airplanes that much, right? And so that was kind of an eye-opening experience.
Yeah.
Looking out the window, it was still 45 minutes to go to land at LAX, and we are already flying over the city. And I remember looking out the window and thinking, how big is this thing? Like just flying over the sea of lights, you know, that was kind of a great experience for me as a European, where the cities are generally a lot smaller.
Yeah.
You know, you can hardly see it and then you're already landing. So, yeah.
On the point you were raising in the beginning, I think it just made me thinking of some of the work. Not so sure if you're familiar from Bill Mogridge, for example. One of the founders of IDEO, who also, I think what is interesting is almost like, I'm thinking if what we're having right now with AI is kind of similar, where there is just a new technology and people trying to figure it out. And I think that's how it sounds like, you know, there was a machine, a computer, and you experimented with it. There was a new sense of adventure and exploration. If you look into, if you look into, like, let's say from 2015 to 2021, there was less of that than I feel like there is again right now because of the wave of AI and like the how people are empowered to experiment with the technology. It's again, mm-hmm. it's maybe to not to that degree like it used to be maybe with during your times with the invention of the computer, right? Where maybe it was a bigger shift, you know, because the AI is just building out on computer, you know, that we, so I think maybe it was less dramatic, but I feel like, you know, it's kind of these technology waves where you were part of these like early explorations. How can a machine and a human interact? What kind of experience can be created? What's the dialogue? The reason why I mentioned Bill Morgridge is because Bill Morgridge really explored in his body of work, specifically in his early days, was the interaction between also computers and mouses and keyboards and like how that works, of course, with his company IDEO. But yeah, and I feel like you were working in a similar context, maybe even more connected to content and the experimentations around media, right? But
yeah, I mean, it really shifted for me from like when the story I told you, like, think about it, the Commodore C64 did not have a mouse. I mean, the input was a keyboard and arrow keys. That's how you navigated the screen. So I saw the transition from kind of a text-based input, and I had to learn a fair share of programming to work on, you know, Unix machines, for example. There was like half of the stuff you were able to do with a mouse, the other half you had to do in a terminal. And I remember quite clearly that at some point I had to make the decision, do I want to become an engineer and write code, or do I want to stay on the design side? And I picked the design side. It's always been my passion, but the time commitment to learn either, right, was really large. And I think that touches on what you're just saying. It's like we were early in picking up those skills out of sheer excitement about what's possible. And those skills then allowed me to work, right? Like that there's another interesting thing. It wasn't just doing research and trying to talk to the machine. It was also that, like, my first paid work using a computer, there were two jobs I had while I was in college. Was one was writing articles about software for a local computer magazine. I used a Mac Plus for that and a black and white text editor. And the other job was to simulate computer interfaces for television shows, mostly crime shows. Hamburg has quite a big media scene. There a lot of TV shows were produced. And when you see, you know, the police inspector go to a computer and input a name and then an interface appears that shows the picture of a criminal, et cetera. That is not real software. Somebody like me usually makes that. And that was the first work that I was able to do with the skills I had acquired to support myself through college. So I think it's interesting when you think about today, where there's kind of a lot of polarizing conversation about AI is going to replace us. I think AI is a skill, right? AI is a skill level to learn in order to do a different job than, or do the job that you're doing differently than you've done in the past.
Yeah, it's a different type of innovation than what we have been discussing earlier with the invention of the computer, right?
Yeah, and I'm doing some mentoring on ADP list, and the questions, one of the questions that comes up really is like, what do I do to, you know, catch up with AI? Like, what do I need to know as a designer? And you know, I'm as early as anyone else. I haven't really gone super deep, and I've used and played with the tools that are out there. But one of the things I found the most interesting challenge is that AI will require us designers to think about more probabilistic interfaces. Like, it's not that clear what's going to happen when you input a command. I'm brainstorming here with you, but I think we have to think about a possibility of return parameters from the AI versus you click here and this is going to happen, right? Like, so I think there's a lot to explore there, and I'm not really ready to, you know, give any solid advice, but I think that's kind of the next big challenge for the UX community is like, what do you do when a computer interface actually doesn't tell you exactly what it's going to give back to you?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, right? Because how do you navigate that? And I feel like it's interesting that, you know, for example, with ChatGPT is that people talk a lot about prompts. And almost that prompts become, it's like learning a keyboard, you know, learning a...
Yeah, yeah, right. Instrument. Prompt engineering is kind of prompt like what I did on a Unix
machine.
Prompt engineering
came out, which is just basically a different type of inputting, you know? I mean, I could say these things too, But suddenly, I mean, like, it's almost like a new type of controlling something, like prompt engineering. And I'm wondering if that's it, if it's gonna really about prompt engineering, because prompt engineering by definition means that, and maybe for good and for bad, I'm kind of limited to like the way I'm input and like how much I know about the machine, you know? It's not the most natural way of interacting, right? I think like, I mean, a tool creates freedom, but a tool always creates restriction at the same time, right? And the restriction of a tool makes a tool interesting, you know? So for example, if you see like how people are designing on Figma and like, well, like, you know, why a lot of designs look similar, it's because there's just the tool set, you know? You click on this and like, you know, by definition, by the presets, you kind of end up with this design, you know? And you are very influenced by like what other people are doing and so on, you know? So you can see a lot of similarities there as far as like how people are designing with, depending on the tool, right? You have something like Midjourney, things start to look different, you know? If you have, you know, like if you design at Photoshop, like it's just gonna look different. You're gonna use different effects and all of it. You tend to, of course you can match it, but just to the natural process of using the tool. So that's the limitation a tool provides, and that working with the limitation is always what makes it interesting. But and I feel like with AI, I guess there's a natural way maybe where I would just don't have to change myself as far as like how I'm interacting with an AI. I would just like try to control it as I would like to communicate, and the machine is trying to learn me. And there's other way. There's also this kind of like this mouse pad, which is like the prompt engineering that I have to learn, you know, where I'm gonna act different now because I know I control this machine. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's kind of like this bandwidth of interaction, right?
I'm just generally super, super excited and curious to see what's gonna happen with it, because going back to the old days, like there was a few of us working on 3D animations when we did those TV projects, and there was a few folks that were artists that weren't that computer literate, like they didn't have the animation or computer graphic skills, and they would, you know, sometimes come by and say like, hey, can you make this look different, and blah blah, and you know, like the usual kind of art director designer problem, like somebody's looking over your shoulder. And your machine literally had just rendered for 4 days to crank out those poor 240 frames. And you were like, no, I really don't want to do that unless you have another week. But the joke that came out of it for us was that we said every 3D program should have a button in the interface that says render horse. Like, just render me a horse, which is really complicated to do in a 3D program. Like, as a skilled 3D animator, to create a horse is hard. So the joke was render horse. And here I am, 25-ish years later, and literally a prompt to Midjourney saying render horse is not that far off a prompt that would actually give you horse back. So it's also kind of exciting and mind blowing how that has evolved, right? And that's what I meant when I say that the UX and UI paradigms are going to change. It becomes probabilistic, because render horse doesn't tell you like how big is the horse. Is it a black horse? Yeah. Is it a white horse? Right?
There are so many. I think we haven't even started to understand what the impact is going to be. And I think it's maybe touching on two things. One is the whole generative design part, which I would love to talk with you about, also in context of your content and media background. The other part is also, I recently had that discussion quite often with colleagues, is that you're thinking about the main principles of an interface, right? If you're looking at a phone, for example, like an app, like you take any app, like there are principles. Like, you don't even think about it. There's a bar at the bottom, the icons in the corner, like there are some patterns that you don't even challenge. And people start to design things, they're based on like what they think is familiar to people, you know? And I think that makes sense, because you're trying to make a website familiar. No, I think what is going to be interesting and is that, what if we kind of completely make stuff with a white paper now, right? So what if we are saying like, is all of that needed? I'm talking to an intelligence. So what do I actually need as input? Is it not different? Like, is it just like, I don't know, like a circle in the middle that I press on and I say something and has to visualize it back and I have to respond in a certain way? Like the whole interaction as far as like physical, verbally, maybe the way I'm maybe, even with the way I'm maybe expressing facial expression and like how it's get read, you know? All of these aspects, I think like there is an opportunity to really rethink the basics. If we're really thinking about an AI first interface, which would mean like it's not manually first, click, 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 but it's actually AI first. Basically, it tries to understand the input first. How would an interface change? I don't know if there are any explorations on that yet, you know, because AI sort of in interfaces is more done in an augmented way where I have an interface and I augment elements with AI. So I say I have a slider component and the AI already tells me what it needs to be here, or it tells me information automatically generated and so on, or I have like some kind of chat bubble or something like that, but it's more done on top of what we already know. But I would be very interested to see how these user interfaces start like to completely change from scratch. And then we would look into an app like it is so familiar today and we're saying that looks kind of old school. You know, that feels like old school. I think there is something there. I haven't even understood myself what the impact is going to be, but I assume if AI would empower for new ways of interacting with a machine, it would, you know, it's going to completely change that. And it may be also even connected to audio, and because maybe you don't need visual content for all of the different things. And I think, I think that's going to be just interesting times ahead. Yeah.
It's super interesting. I'm just, because we're casually chatting about this, I'm just going to say something that popped into my head when I started playing with Midjourney and DALL-E in the beginning and other things. It's like in video encoding, you know, my friends in media engineering always say garbage in, garbage out, right? If you if you feed bad looking video into an encoder, the video that comes out isn't going to look great either. So if the AI draws on everything digital that's available to it as information about how it's going to generate your response, right? And the responses of an AI become part of the overall knowledge of humanity on the internet. Mm-hmm. Isn't it essentially degrading its quality, just like if you were making a photocopy over and over and over again over time? Yeah. So I think this is a long way of saying we shouldn't immediately throw in the towel and say AI is going to rule it all. I think we as humans need to ensure the quality and the unbiased and inclusive nature of AI is still very much our job, right? I mean, regardless of the gold rush to, you know, say AI and everything's AI enabled and AI powered, there's definitely kind of a rush to that. And that's very attractive. And I think there's a new frontier there, but I also believe that it's pretty far from, you know, having found its form in a way that you and I know how we're going to use it in our everyday lives. You know, when we talk about these image generators, and let's maybe just stay with that as designers, you know, you get four versions of what you think you said, but there isn't really any tools yet to kind of refine that and really drive it towards an output that is satisfying to you, right? And I think that's going to come over time.
Yeah, absolutely. The controls are not there yet. It's like the mouse is not invented yet. I think we're experimenting, you know.
Yeah. I would challenge and say there is a Midjourney look, right? Like you see an image and somebody said, hey, I made this on Midjourney. And a friend of mine just said, I put hair on my face. You know, he's bald. And so he was like, yeah, but it does look like you used Midjourney to do it. So when that goes away, right?
Yeah.
Then I think when designers can control it in a way that it can be anything really, and really mean something, I think that's when we're closer to having it as a successful tool.
Essentially, I mean, like we're going into a world where we're creating almost synthetic realities, right? That's where it's all going, right? That we are able to create synthetic realities that 100% be able to control it. But it is, of course, the big elephant in the room with all of this is like what kind of content you can still trust. How do you know something's actually real versus synthetic, you know?
Or is it actually the best positive outcome of this whole thing is that future generations know not to trust it? Like there's a real...
You can trust nothing, you know, then.
But our bodies haven't changed. We can still trust each other, but maybe there's a more healthy relationship to a digital output versus, you know, my kids grew up with social media, and as parents, because it all happened at the same time, like we grew up with social media, the same time my kids did, we didn't really know what harm it would do to them, right? It was new and exciting. And now they're actually moved, now that they're 18, 20 years old, they've moved past it and they're actually not using it as much anymore because they put it in the right bucket. They're like, oh, this is where things always look like this. And that's not real. So they actually moved back to texting and, you know, more in-person interactions. And the social media sphere has become part of their communication structure and communication skills, but it's not a reality anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably its own podcast to kind of think about.
Oh, I think so too. I think we already started a new podcast.
Because, I mean, it's like they can go into that topic forever because there's so many consequences of that. I don't think like, I think like people, it's so mind shifting to think about the fact that in the future, like we are so used to trust the information we get, you know?
Yeah.
I think. And you mentioned something interesting I haven't thought about, where it's like, maybe now it's the human that tells you it instead of an external source, right? Maybe the human becomes now like the important factor, but the only the human that you actually know, because all of the other humans, you don't, you know, like you can have any person in a Zoom call. You don't know if it's a real person or not. It can be a bot, you know, because it's,
I know.
And so is that like where we're heading, you know, that like basically only if I have shaked your hand and you told me, look at this image, then I can actually trust that. And before I never know. And it's almost like going back, like almost when we were living in villages and like the information you got was only,
you know, trusting Sebastian, trusting or not trusting is also a pretty binary way of looking at the world, right? I would say it's complicated. It always has been complicated. Like, you know, you were never really able to trust that the text message you got were from the person that it's from the phone that you know. It's not from the person that you know. So I think that a healthy level of skepticism in the world is not a
it's
bad
always,
thing.
It's always, yeah. Yeah. Just to end it, I think there is more opportunity for harm now than maybe there used to be. Because just the limitation of creating these realities, it wasn't there to the degree that you will always basically be able to somehow maybe judge it a little bit. But yeah, there was always skeptic. I agree with that. But we may be doing it like another episode on that, where we're talking on like content and I mean, your strong background in with Disney Plus, at the same time now Udemy. Like, how do you think about that, and as far as content creation, visual design, and you know, crafting these interfaces? We have been casually chatting also about the fact that one of the things at Disney Plus was the fact that you had to align so many images and you had to deal with a lot of content that maybe was sometimes third party, sometimes you were able to control it yourself. So that's of course one component as far as like how do you deal with that, but mm-hmm. at the same time it's also how you the content itself, you know. How do you look at that as far as especially content related products, content related digital experiences? How do you think generative design, generative art, video creation even is going to change kind of these products over the, let's say, next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, maybe I'll go try to pick up my journey a little bit where I left off to explain how I even sure. ended up at Disney. I think might be interesting for me to explain yeah. like why I did there, what I did ultimately. But really, I came to the United States, made a lot of friends and found a lot of people that were kind of in the same exciting state of let's bring video and audio to the internet. And I ended up with a group of folks in San Francisco where I ultimately moved to. And we started an online radio station called the Beta Lounge in 96. And that was really the first time that we did serious media production for the internet at a time when the internet was really not quite ready for it. We used a technology called the Real Player. So we didn't build the technology, but we used it. It became really successful for a lot of reasons. One of them being that music rights on the internet were relatively unfigured out at the time. The company didn't survive as a company. It survived as a concept. I think today there is something called the Boiler Room. They're more or less still doing the same. They do a party and they put it on the internet, and it's a ton of fun.
Yeah.
To kind of have both, right? You're at a party, but it's also being broadcast to the world. Ultimately, we turned that company, me and a partner, Joe Rice, who was then the CTO, into our design and development agency called MX Productions. and in the Bay Area. And, you know, with my background in animation and illustration, I've just always been a huge Pixar fan. And it was always my dream to maybe one day work at Pixar. And I came pretty close because Pixar became our client in the Bay Area right around the time that they were bought by Disney. And so then they introduced us to Disney, and the company I worked on did a lot of kind of marketing, digital marketing work for Hollywood titles. Like, we built second screen experiences, we built alternate reality games, just a lot of kind of emerging experiences on mobile devices when movies mm-hmm. came out. And so that company we ran for approximately 7 or 8 years. And we're, you know, kind of getting to a point, me and my partner, where the technology we were using, working with the movie industry, who wasn't really investing into sustainable technologies, ran its course. And we decided to sell the business. And we had friends at Major League Baseball Advanced Media, which was the in-house streaming company at Major League Baseball. And they acquired us and turned our company into the San Francisco office for Major League Baseball Advanced Media. So I did end up working for baseball for a while, which was a, kind of a great experience because we owned the content. As an mm-hmm. agency, you kind of make experiences, you don't own the content. You make sometimes really great experiences, but it's not a sustainable work where you stay connected to the product in a way. You hand it over.
You can control the content creation, the cameras, the art direction, right. but also the after production, right? It's both in your hand, right? And right. like, I can imagine, like, sometimes this creative process is splitted, right? You get some kind of recording and you have to make something out of it, right? Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And at baseball, we were literally involved in the whole production chain from the field mm-hmm. where we got real-time data of pitch speed and running speed of the outfielders, et cetera, all the way to the interface that visualized it. And that was a super cool experience, really, to work on that. And also for me as a German, not knowing the sport, to kind of having to learn it in order to, you know, in order to design for it. Mm-hmm. It was also my first, like, after I had to run my own business, which as a designer, I would say kind of took me away from designing and put me more kind of in a managing the business and managing designer role, which I surprisingly really, really liked. And I still do. That was kind of the beginning, I think, for me to think about design at scale, where I saw the impact that larger design teams can have versus a small agency team that can really just run one project at a time. So at baseball, I was given the opportunity to run product and design for MLB TV and our third-party clients. We launched HBO Now as part of MLBAM, et cetera. And ultimately, MLBAM was spun out as a company called BAMTech, which then was acquired by Disney, funny enough, to build Disney Plus. So I kind of came full circle from having Disney as a vendor, being able to, you know, work on Pixar titles, to then being brought into Disney, and MLBAM, BAMTech, then renamed into Disney Streaming, essentially became the group, the department inside of Disney that built Disney Plus. So that's mm-hmm. kind of how I ended up there. And I can just kind of pick up on your question around how to design for something like that. And maybe there's a couple of stories that are interesting to talk about. One of them is the actual process of thinking and creating the artwork. And the other thing is, you know, how does the Disney Plus interface differentiate itself from other streaming services? Like, what was unique about Disney Plus and what is unique about Disney Plus? Mm-hmm. Starting with the artwork, I think there was a pretty interesting story. So I was, quote unquote, in charge of product and design mm-hmm. for Disney Plus. And the first task we had was to make the logo, which was not necessarily a product design challenge, but it was the first thing that the company needed after the name was decided, to be able to announce to the world that there was going to be a streaming service and when it was going to launch. And mm-hmm. obviously Bob Iger wanted to have the Disney Plus logo behind him on a screen when he made that announcement. So the team made the logo, and that's another story for another day to tell, but it was also a really great experience. So we were basically just getting initial requirements together and kind of building wireframes and thought about what is the existing UX paradigm for a streaming service, what does Netflix do, what does Prime do, what do we have to do different. And then I got the studio marketing team had hired a new VP that was going to be responsible for the originals and you kind of the content pipeline. Yeah. And a guy named Andy Baker down in Burbank, he emailed me a PDF and said, hey, are you seeing this? Because I think somebody here has been approving these and I don't actually know what to do with it. And I looked at the PDF and it was artwork for legacy Disney titles that was being produced by the studio operations team for the Disney Plus service. And that was kind of a big aha moment, because the team that created that artwork, not to their fault, had never been given a chance to think about the artwork in context of the whole application. They were taking one title at a time. They took the DVD cover, they cut it to size. They maybe adjusted the contrast and up-resed it a little bit and or whatever. And so we immediately responded to that. And ultimately, in collaboration with the studio marketing team, built a product design team that generated the specification for the artwork, so that all of the studios and agencies around the world that create content for Disney would understand what it would mean to build artwork that coexists as the ultimate home for all of Disney content, and together create a premium experience, the premium experience that Disney wanted to present to the world. So that was kind of an interesting way of expanding what product design maybe traditionally does in other companies, and really also a big learning on cross collaboration between teams with very different motivations. Like studio marketing, still their job is to make the biggest event possible out of every new movie that Disney launches, right? They think about that one movie. That's the most important thing that we have right now. But to insert a team into that, that out of the gate starts thinking about what assets do we now need to create for Disney Plus while we still have all of these assets online, right? Like to be able to influence and collaborate on that level was a really great experience.
Yeah, we can almost think about it as, you know, even as a training or guidelines, right? Like an internal training program, right? I mean, it's so difficult to successfully achieve the premium digital experience with Disney Plus using the application myself. I can at least like tell that. But it's so difficult to achieve that, you know, specifically depending on the skill set of person you have to deal with, you know, like. And I couldn't help myself to think about that AI could maybe solve that in the future. Like, in any way, I mean, to, I mean, at BMW, it was kind of similar to some degree, because we had to also, we had an interface, but we had to deal, you know, with images that are coming from somewhere completely else. And there was no way to influence the content creation so much. It was more like, what do you do with it?
But, and, but it's interesting. But I, you probably have the same experience. The people that created those images were very much creating them on brand, right? They were probably perfectly fine in the context of BMW, wherever they were creating them. And that's the same, you know, that's kind of the same here. It's like when you have a company of that size with a brand that is that big, the focus on what does the brand really mean in one focal point. Sometimes it, you know, it can create a great amount of clarity, but it can also be a burden, right? Like I can, maybe I can think of one example in the creation of Disney Plus. You know, Disney has and used to have, it's magic, right? Like magic is the word that's associated with Disney experiences across the world. So when the app didn't exist, the conversation about how magical can the experience of Disney Plus be was a really, really big conversation inside of the company, right? Like there were a lot of experiences that had like the extra pixie dust, like the extra, you know, the extra sound effect, the extra this, the extra that, to make it like feel like Disney. And it was very difficult for us to find like the right expression of the brand in concert with thinking about a modern streaming UI, streaming user experience that essentially had to function and not distract, right? And so one of the things that I really appreciated about Bob Iger in those situations was that he was able to go into a room filled with people that were all trying to figure out how this was going to work, and with like one or two sentences provide clarity that the rest of the team could rally behind. And in this one instance, I remember him saying, you know, very simple, very clear, I really want our customers to get to video as fast as possible. So without even saying no or yes to anything, he kind of set the clear path forward to, it's got to be video first. Like the content is the magic, right? It's not the UX. We don't want to play a 30-second you know, animation before you watch a video, et cetera. So that was kind of a way to kind of also set the course and then rally a lot of the people, like you were talking about, that were creating content for the service behind that. Like it's got to be clear, simple. It still has to feel, look and feel like Disney, but it's got to be quick to video because that's what people come here for.
It's interesting. If you, I don't know if you know the story behind the Instagram redesign a couple of years ago.
I do not.
Okay, I can maybe then share it shortly, because it's kind of tells a story about a complete different bookend. I think what you experienced at Disney and even my experience at BMW was the other bookend. Let me explain what I mean. So you can have interfaces that are, or can have brands that are just like more emotional by have its own kind of identity and are more emotional. And that's certainly maybe the case for Disney, and like the certain case for BMW. People connect a lot of emotions with this brand. With Disney, it's about like people's childhood and, you know, all of these great movies, and there's a lot of emotion going on, and people have similar kind of emotional connection to a brand like BMW. And with Instagram redesign, I don't know when, it's probably like, you know, 6 years ago or four years ago, I don't know. Redesigned the app. It used to have some colors in there. I don't know if you recall, but you know, it used to have like some blue tones and so on, but it doesn't have this anymore. If you actually look at the Instagram redesign, it actually doesn't have any color. No, I think they start to add a blue here and there, maybe for CTAs, you know, but like it's pretty much black and white. And that was the story behind behind Instagram's redesign. Said like, we want to have a content first interface. That means like the UI should be like completely in the background. That's why we're adding colors, because the colors are just distracting from the content, you know? So it should be just black and white and like super clean, you know? And that's it, you know? Should be interfering with the content at all. Then if you look at the icon of Instagram, the app icon, that has a lot of color, because I mean, it is not in interrelation with the content, right? But if you open it, everything you see is the content and all the elements are just black and white. And that's of course because it's more limited screen space, utility driven. Of course, people, it's not that people open the app of Instagram, they want to have an Instagram experience because they love the brand so much. It's more of a vehicle to deliver the content. And for them, it makes sense, but it shows the completely other bookend, like of content first interfaces. And then you have that going towards more emotional brands like BMW or Disney, where actually it was quite a challenge, I can tell you, at BMW, because we had an interface that was speaking a lot of emotion. And then we had this 3D content that we couldn't, like the third-party content we couldn't even control. And how do you make this work that you're not ending up with a complete mess of colors, you know? So this was kind of a challenge where even within the realm of emotional digital interfaces, we had to at some moments of the experience kind of tune back because it got very third party and then you don't want to interfere so much. And there were moments where you're more control, where you can go more emotional because you control the experience 100%. And that's interesting, you know, in that world, you have to slide back and forth depending on the control you have. I'm wondering about your thoughts then.
We did have to interfere, right? I mean, and interference is, in this case, I think the point I was trying to make, not a negative word. Like, we didn't go around telling people what to do. But what we really had to do is lead with design examples and make people understand that their work would shine more, would surface better, would get more engagement if we work together on creating kind of a coherent experience, which is really hard when you think about how many thousands of design items are in that surface, right? And maybe another anecdote, when you said like, you know, Instagram decided to go all black and take the blue out and all that. Like, I just remembered that there were streaming services and it was the discussion was literally, what color can we own, right? So there's like, Disney luckily has a lot of blue. And now I think in the streaming world, blue, that type of kind of blue is synonymous with Disney Plus. But there was also kind of an important distinction. Like, if you open Netflix, it's black with a lot of red in it. If you open Amazon Prime, it's mostly black with some yellow in it. HBO at the time, I think, was black and white. Yeah. And then Disney needed to have like an identity. And, you know, Hulu was bright green. So it's not all just,
there are, you know,
you're never in a silo. Like, when,
You build
products for millions of people. You got to think about what else they're using.
Sure. And for example, if you design the app logo for the Apple TV, for people to click on it, you need to think about like how the others are looking and how do you differentiate there. And like, of course, context always matter in if you design these experiences. And And yeah, I feel like what you're pointing out is like, also, how do you motivate a lot of people that you cannot control to deliver content for you that is as great as possible? And they understand the value it creates for them. And sometimes, you know, people figure this out for themselves. I have to think about, for example, YouTube and how people figure out like what the biggest YouTube thumbnails and their videos online in terms of like, hey, you should design a thumbnail like this. And people put so much energy into the thumbnail more than in the video, because they say like, you need to hit the thumbnail. It's not the video you need to have good, the thumbnail, because otherwise people don't click on it, you know?
Right.
So like designing that has almost become an art, and there is no guidelines from YouTube as far as like how we should design a thumbnail, you know?
No, but I think they have a good flywheel of energy around, you know, content creators looking at what other content creators are doing.
Yes.
And you know, the old famous Airbnb example, right? Like in 2006, you booked a room on Airbnb and the photos were real candid like, I'm not going to rent that. That looks horrible. And then Airbnb somehow figured out how to up the game and make certain properties look really, really nice. And then everybody else is like, oh, if I want to rent out my room, I better take better pictures.
Leading by example.
And it's kind of the same. It's kind of the same thing we did. Like even a relatively, like, let's say a non-blockbuster title on Disney Plus, if we do our job right, looks really good, looks really descriptive, looks like attractive, looks like it's maybe something I want to click on, or at least is clear on if you're the audience or somebody else is the audience, right? And that I think is a big accomplishment at scale. And it's now, you know, it's thanks to a really incredible artwork team, I think it's still looking really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of think it's kind of like, it's almost like with everything, like it's basically like leading by, or like pointing out what works, right? And I mean, in the case of YouTube, it's almost like done via an algorithm that, you know, these videos are just the most popular ones that are popping up, and then people kind of copy that kind of style, you know?
Right.
And you can also do it, so, and that's done almost systematically, like how do you teach a community to know what is best? If all of the sorting interface is done via algorithms, you can maybe, that is controlled by the numbers actually, by the performance.
Right.
It's probably even almost the most honest way to judge like a design. And then like on the other side, if you manage the team, I mean, you as a, like we have managed so many teams during your career, like it's the same thing, right? I mean, like how do you motivate team to go in a certain direction or motivate them for something? It's like you highlight the impact the team can create with that project. And if you want to do them certain actions, you also, of course, like if it's a team meeting or whatever, you highlight these positive contributions that were made in the direction that is aligning with where you want to go. And then people know, okay, this is what gets appreciated, you know, and that's how people change their behaviors in an organization. And that's how we can drive organizational change and so on. And that's driven more by the human than the algorithm. Yeah. But it's kind of essentially the same thing. Whatever is the direction you want to go, you highlight that, you give that a trophy, you highlight that.
I think ultimately when you say how to motivate large groups of people, I think ultimately as a product designer, I would hope that you're in that job because you want to make people's lives better. It's not necessarily, not 100% what you're working on shouldn't be. Like, you know, it shouldn't be the brand. It should really just also be the challenge in any kind of context to improve kind of the quality of the experience.
What would be interesting is to think a little bit about also your new role at Udemy.
Yeah.
And what are you looking forward to? And what is the impact designers can create in the context of educational content, edutainment? Why is it exciting you? Why should it excite creatives to push that topic forward? I think this place, this area always has been playing a critical role overall. I mean, like no more and more because people are consuming education more and more online.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that's one of the big reasons.
It's one of the big reasons
why I joined. I think there's kind of two sides to it. I think Udemy is a really great product. It's in a really great space as being a force for good in how, you know, we evolve in terms of how we consume educational content, how we learn. I think there is to the topic that we kind of dabbled in earlier with AI, et cetera. Yeah. I think there's an amazing opportunity in learning to use AI as a companion technology to support learning and make learning faster on multiple sides, like give instructor tools, to create better classes by being faster to market with their classes, by using AI to help create the classes, but also for learners to, you know, and, you know, this is obviously nothing's fully baked, but also to really, really increase the learning experience, to be more granular, more focused, more track better, you know, what has been learned, what you should be learning, what you haven't learned, et cetera. So those are the types of things that I'm really looking forward to in terms of helping the product. And, you know, again, if we are thinking that, you know, the rise of AI requires new skills for people to have good jobs, then I think Udemy is one of those platforms where I would hope people would go to acquire those skills. And, you know, supporting that, just as AI, just as an example, I know there's lots of skills that you can learn. But as an example, I think that was one of the greatest selling points for me. And the other thing that I'm really excited about is like great teams and building new things, right? Building teams, building new things. And I think Udemy is kind of at a point where, you know, their investment in a better user experience is incredibly timely and a really great challenge for me to take on with the team. And they have done amazing stuff. So I'm super happy to be there, but I've been there for literally 28 days. So, or less, 23 days. So give me a little time. Let's talk about that job again in a year, but so far it's been really great.
Yeah. I would love to, like, looking at the current progress of technology, I'm looking forward also maybe in 1 year to talk with you about like how AI has influenced all of this, you know, because we touched on that.
I should know a lot more.
Yeah, I think in 1 year you learned a lot more about that, and maybe so because you know, some new innovations coming out, and maybe this is going to change content creation and you know, to some degree, and how does it influence then creative teams and product teams and so on. And yeah, let's have that discussion in the year. Yeah. So, well, thank you so much for coming on, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, super, super nice conversation, Sebastian. I'm glad we finally did this. Really enjoyed it. Can't wait to hear how it came out.
Thank you so much. All right, that was the episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to give it a thumbs up and let me know in the comments about your thoughts and biggest learnings from the episode. I'm always super curious about that. You can also tag me in a post about your biggest takeaway and share your insight with others to pass on your learnings. If the episode provided you a lot of value, make sure to follow, subscribe, and share it with friends and colleagues so they also have the chance to learn and grow. Until next time, cheers.